Thanks for being here this evening. My name is Kevin Conover. I'm your host on Educate for Life Radio. We're broadcasting down here in Southern California on KPRZ 1210 AM and also on FM 106.1 in North County. And I have a guest this evening who was on my show back in November, Dr. Russ Humphreys. And he has a degree in physics from Duke University. He has a PhD in physics on cosmic rays and ultra-high energy nucleon-nucleon interactions from LSU. He's worked in the high voltage laboratory of General Electric Company, designing and inventing equipment and researching high voltage phenomena. He has all kinds of credentials. He has two US patents, and he's received awards from Sandia National Laboratories in New Mexico in nuclear physics, geophysics, pulse powered research, and theoretical atomic and nuclear physics. And Dr. Humphreys, thanks for coming on again.
My pleasure to be on.
Absolutely.
One thing I wanted to ask you, are some of your viewers only on audio? Can they
Yes,
only?
we're on podcast, so some people are only on audio. I know we have slides here to share, but they'll have to check us out on YouTube if they find it very if they want more
Okay.
details.
So could you remind them occasionally about the YouTube so that they won't be completely in the dark, because this is
Absolutely.
a very visual presentation. So they can catch up on the visual on YouTube. So,
Absolutely. I love it. Okay.
okay.
So, for those of you listening, we are on podcast. I know a lot of people listen on podcasts. So, if you want the visuals, it's on YouTube and it'll be up on my site as well, educateforlife.org. You can check it out. Dr. Humphreys, before we hop into the slides, I know we're picking up where we left off from the last time, talking about evidence for a young world. And, I did a little bit of research and it said that the one of the recent polls that came out in 2019 said that about 40% of Americans actually believe in a 6-day creation, and they don't believe in evolution, and they believe basically what the Bible says, which that's 4 out of 10 people,
That's
and
great. I didn't
yeah,
know it was that high.
it is. It's pretty high, and it goes on to explain that some people believe in evolution, but they believe God used evolution. And then a smaller percent believe that it's just evolution on its own, which is somewhere around between 20 and 30%. But one of the stats that they were talking about was that people with higher education, the more advanced degrees they have, the more likely they are to not believe in creation, is what the stats show. And I was just wondering about your thoughts on that, because you're incredibly well educated. You have your background is amazing. How would you respond to somebody who said, "Hey, look, the majority of Americans who believe in creation are less educated than those who don't"? What would you say to somebody who said something like that?
Well, I guess first of all, I'm a counterexample, and so are several thousand other scientists who are quite well educated, and they're young Earth creationists. But the other thing I would say is that even before I was a Christian, I tended to question what the establishment, educational establishment, was telling me. There were some things that seemed kind of fishy. And so I think I would advise those educated old earthers to develop a more skeptical attitude and go back to what scripture says and compare what they are believing with what scripture says. But I think you'll find, actually, if you examine the evidence, of which I'm going to give some samples, that you'll find that the evidence is much more in favor of a young world than in a billions of years old world. So it's unfortunately, education, you develop the habit of pleasing your professors. And if your professors are atheists, and about half of them in the secular establishment are atheists, you're going to get their point of view on life. And so I urge such people who have gotten that kind of education to realize that the data and the truth may not be at all what they learned. So they just have to develop some skepticism.
One of the examples of that I always I've heard several people who went through, high school, undergrad, graduate, and then on into becoming a professor before they finally became a skeptic and started saying, "Whoa, hold on. These are assertions. This is not evidence of this particular paradigm." And began to be a little upset because they said, "Well, why wasn't this pointed out to me earlier on? Why am I just now learning about the problems with this particular paradigm, the evolutionary worldview, the secular worldview?" And so it's worth taking the time to look into it and going, "Okay, where is the real evidence here, or are these just assumptions?" But let's hop into your research here and your what you have to share with us. We can pick up where we left off. And get into these the evidences that show that Earth is recently created, not billions of years old.
Okay, so if we can switch to my slides.
Yep, I've got it up right here in front of me here.
Okay, all right, I'll assume that everyone is seeing my slide then. In part one, last November, I gave five simple evidences that the world is not billions of years old. And I'll review those a little later in this talk. But here's another simple piece of evidence that the world is young. So you should be seeing, Kevin, this slide that says, "Not enough Stone Age graves." Do you see
Yep.
that slide?
Yep. It's right up there.
Now, the Stone Age is when we were using stone tools, not metal tools, according to the evolutionists. And it pretty well coincides with the Ice Age, which, according to Bible and science evidence, occurred after the Genesis flood for the next 700 to 1,000 years. But now here's the evolutionist view of that time. If you can see my cursor here, I'm running it along the bottom from the right, which is where the cursor is now, is about where we are today. And then this dotted line here is about 5,000 years ago. And then 195,000 years past that is this part of the graph. So that's time. And then the vertical axis is number of people on the earth, the total number of people at any given time. And then this is 1 million, and I'll talk about why that's there in a moment. So the graph I'm going to show you is the evolutionary point of view. So first they think the population rose very rapidly, and then it leveled off for a reason I'm about to tell you. It leveled off, and they estimate between 1 million people and 10 million people. I'm taking the lower estimate because that's more favorable to their point of view, as we'll see in a moment.
Quick
So,
question, Dr. Humphreys. You've got the 195,000 years on here plus 5,000 years. Is this the evolutionary claim of when people, evolved and then started as we are? Is that what we're
yes,
looking at here?
that is the latest claim, or at least it was up to a few years ago, and maybe it still is. This is the pure Homo sapiens has
So,
been dated. The oldest Homo sapiens has been dated at about 200,000 years ago.
and prior to that, it was some less evolved creature according to evolutionary time
Yes,
frames.
yes,
Okay.
but actually, Neanderthal man. Is Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis. So, and then there's archaic Homo sapiens, or basically European looking Homo sapiens. And so the oldest that I have seen in the literature is about 200,000 years ago, according to several different radioactivity dating methods. So that's their picture of when Homo sapiens started. So rose rapidly and then leveled off. And why did it level off? It's because of their alleged lifestyle. They hunted and gathered. They didn't have agriculture. And so there's only so many acres on the earth, and that limits the population. They estimate between 1 million and 10 million people at any given time. So it leveled off. What that means is every generation, as many people were dying as were being born. So every generation, 1 million people dying. But what's a generation? It's the length of time it takes a child to be born and then grow up to where he has children of his own. So maybe 25 years or so. We don't know exactly what conditions would, were supposed to be like then, but life was supposed to be short and brutish, so 25 years seems kind of reasonable for a generation. Now, if we take the whole time of 200,000 years and divide by 25 years, we get 8,000 generations, roughly, in that time. So how many people would have died? The answer, oh, by the way, I'm showing you now, 5 or 10,000 years ago, the evolutionary view is that somebody discovered farming and
took them a long time.
Yes, that's one very peculiar thing about it. Why would it take Stone Age people were not stupid. We have lots of evidence of that. In fact, it probably is harder for modern man to transport ourselves back to the Ice Age and try to survive. Maybe we wouldn't think we were so smart.
Yeah.
So anyhow, after farming took the lid off, then we increased to the 8 billion people we now have in less than 5,000 years. So now, how many people would have died? And the answer is 8 billion graves, 8 billion Stone Age graves during that period, roughly.
Yes, so 8,000 times 1 million, because that's how many generations. So we should be seeing that many, whatever, graves or bones or something. Yeah,
we should. And they buried their stone tools in the graves too, though, so that if everything decayed, there'd still be necklaces and stone axes and spearheads and all buried in the grave. They apparently like to bury their dead. So 8 billion, that's one grave for every person alive on this planet. So we should be finding lots of Stone Age graves. And how many do we really find? Only thousands. And that sets a limit to how long the Stone Age could have been, say at most 500 years in various places. And the population had to be lower than a million by quite a bit. And so that fits the biblical picture. The biblical picture is after the flood and after Babel, a scattering of people all over the earth on the move, living in one place only short times and not long enough to smelt some iron or copper and make some metal tools. So they use stone tools. So it would be roughly, according to the biblical picture, from 2500 BC, when the flood was, to the time of Abraham, about 2000 BC, 500 years.
So in which they were living in caves or what do you mean?
Well, when you're on the move and not many trees have grown on the earth, so you can't chop down wood and make a home easily. Mm-hmm. And you can't stop to make bricks or anything else. You're on the, scattering all over the earth. A cave is a very handy place to live. I found that out when I was camping when there was a heavy snow in Grand Canyon. Caves are just great.
So that's really interesting. So are you saying that the explanation from a biblical, a creationist perspective regarding, because people will say, well, how do you explain the cavemen? If people were smart like Noah and so forth, why were they living in caves? So
because it's a smart thing to do in the Ice Age when the weather is not real good. Lots of storms and lots of cold weather and bad weather. And so as you're on the move, if there's a cave handy, use it. You might have to have a little bit of a battle with the resident cave bear, but so what? So that's just meat. which they are given permission to eat by then. So according to God. So yes, that's the picture.
That's great. And you know, and what else is kind of strange about this whole thing is too, is that for 195,000 years, there's no writing or anything.
That's right. I'm
which
going to
is,
talk about that with the next slide.
Oh, okay. I won't short circuit that then. But that's so interesting. And then how do people respond to this? You know, when you talk to somebody and you share this kind of information, what is the risk? Do evolutionists go, well, you know, we don't know why they're not there, but it is what it is. What does somebody say to that?
An evolutionary anthropologist lady in the Grand Canyon I met, her husband was a creationist and a young earther, but I don't think she was. And she had real problems with this. You know, says, well, maybe they weren't, you know, maybe they were buried offshore and the water came and covered them all up. Well, there's just too many of them to hide that way. So,
yeah, 8 billion. I mean, that's incredible.
So I think she was just unable to face the facts.
Yeah.
So, but she was an anthropologist, and I don't think she was a young earther. So that was the answer. Well, somehow it happened.
Yeah. Some sort of rescuing diet. Somehow, just so I don't have to deal with this, I'll just kind of push it away and consider it some sort of anomaly.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the next item is right along the lines you were beginning to hit on, Kevin. By the way, we need to X out that 195,000 years. It's just, you know, clearly wrong. So now the next item is, Kevin, written history is too short. Writing is not that hard for people to do. An Ice Age man recorded phases of the moon on bone, and he made beautiful cave paintings. So why not use, at least have pictographs or like the hieroglyphics of Egypt? Why not use those skills to record history during that alleged 195,000 years? So let's just see. I'm going to plot here a graph. Number of documents in the earth, and it's in the billions now. It's roughly proportional to the number of people. So number of documents produced now is definitely in the billions. And then when the population got smaller, my arrow is down there on the billion side of that axis, and then thousands, and eventually we get down to one. And the time is here on the right, and the bottom is now, and time of Christ, time of Abraham, and the time of Noah. So I'm just going to start on the upper right with now and the billions. So let's just plot, and we'll work backwards to Noah.
For those of you who are just listening on podcast, we do have slides here that are very helpful to illustrate what Dr. Humphreys is sharing with us. So you can check that out on YouTube if you're just listening in on the podcast.
Okay. So, this is something I worried about actually when I was a teenager and not saved. I wondered about the shortness of history. Because as you were saying, Kevin, it's not too hard to invent writing. So during those alleged 195,000 years, we should have had a history recorded, but history is much shorter than that. And let me put the time scale in at the bottom here, about 5,000 years. Now, you could argue and say, well, it's really 7,000 years. Yes, but it's not 195 to 200,000 years. And so we get back, work back to the time of Noah, and we have his logbook and his library aboard the ark, ones or tens. But in only five millennia or so, we have all the books we now have in the world. So written history is just too short to include.
That's really interesting that's actually something you thought about as a teenager. What was it that prompted you to think to be concerned about that?
Well, just reading history books and looking at how they all started and looking at the time scale, And I was raised in evolution, and I knew the time scale for human beings should be much longer than that. What were we doing all that time?
So
So,
where did your mind go with that? Did you look for answers, or were you kind of like, well, hopefully somebody has an answer to this?
no, I got as far as I could, and so I said, okay, I don't know, and then I tabled it.
Yeah. I have coming up in a couple radio shows, Doug Petrovich, who's going to be talking about the origin of languages and his thoughts on, what was the language that existed before the Tower of Babel. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, I think it was pretty definitely, according to scripture, a language very much like Hebrew, because the naming puns, Adam and Eve named their son Seth, which means appointed, because God had appointed him. And Adam named his wife Eve, or Chava, I believe it is in Hebrew, which means life, living. Because she was the mother of all living. And Methuselah's name means something interesting. When he dies, it shall be sent, or something like that. And he died in exactly the year of the flood. And Noah was named by Lamech. He was named Noah because, said Lamech, this one shall bring us rest, or give us rest. So a pun doesn't work if you change the language. You don't get the pun. The words don't have the same sound. So they were pretty clearly speaking something very much like Hebrew.
Wow,
So
that's so interesting.
and then we acquired all the other languages at Babel.
So, as far as you've got one on this chart here. If you go all the way back, you get to the first written piece of information or whatever that is. Do you happen to know what the oldest document is? As far as there something older than the Bible that we have?
It's roughly the oldest document is roughly the same age as what a conservative would say the age of the Bible is. In fact, the oldest document is probably the one that God, the account that God gave Adam, and it's in Genesis 1. And then after that, we have Adam's account. And that's the next few chapters of Genesis. And everywhere you come to a, these are the generations of, probably put in by Noah, by Moses as he's recording some of these family documents. So the oldest one really would be, but we don't have it, unfortunately, but we have a copy of it, Genesis chapter 1.
Now, why do some people say that Mesopotamian cuneiform is the oldest language? I was looking in the, doing a little research on that, and it says that that's the oldest language. Is that biblically accurate?
No, biblically accurate, the oldest language is Hebrew.
But I
So,
mean, in a written
and
document that
they
we
ignored the
have.
Bible, and they don't want to believe that it's true. So then they invent their own theories. So
Sure.
then, so that's why,
Do we, but as far as a document, is the oldest document that we have a Hebrew, or is it some other language?
Now, that's a good question. It used to be there was some other language, but in recent years, archaeological finds have found that Hebrew is much older than they thought. And they've been finding some writings in Israel that are pretty old, the archaeologists have, and they're in Hebrew.
Interesting. That's
So
great.
I would say, I would be a little hesitant if I were them about making pronouncements like you just relayed.
Yeah. Yep.
So,
Yep.
okay. Now, let me just summarize both part one and part two here. Most dating methods say the world is young. About 90% of all the methods you could use to estimate the age of the world, 90% of them appear to say it's much younger than billions of years. So in the first part, we talked about comets and their short age, sea salt, the short age of salt in the ocean, the seafloor mud, short age for that relative to billions of years. The Earth's magnetic field is decaying rapidly and has done interesting things in the past, but the energy in it has looks like it's been steadily decaying at different rates. And then biologic decay, all sorts of things set a limit on how old life on Earth can be. Genetic evidence, mutational evidence. And so then today we talked about Stone Age graves and history being too short. But keep in mind, I mentioned this in the first part, that there are lots of other methods. So let's just start listing a few, but I won't talk about all of them. But fast decay of Saturn's rings, Niagara Falls erosion, fast coal formation, natural gas pressure loss. I'm just picking a few. Seafloor magnetic stripes point to a young Earth.
Well, so, that's a lot.
So now you don't need to be copying all these things because you can get a list online. And it's creation.com. So note that down, creation.com. Great website to go to. And then there's an article on it called 101 Evidences for a Young Age of the Earth. And you can get the article just by taking that phrase, 101 Evidences, and putting it into the search engine. So creation.com, 101 Evidences. There's each of the items of evidence has a short, fairly understandable description, and then it gives you references that you can go to on the internet or in the library and run this data down to where it's recorded in the literature. So that's a great list if you really want the evidence and want to chomp into it. This is a great article to go to. So now that's a summary of the 90% of the evidence that points to a young world. But what about the other 10%? And so what about carbon dating and all that stuff? So let's talk about two samples of all that stuff. Now, evolutionists believe that fossils should have no carbon-14 in them. Now, why is that? Well, the carbon-14 half-life is short compared to other radioactive stuff. It's only 5,700 years. Now, half-life means it's how long it takes to go from, say, a pound of carbon-14 to a half a pound of carbon-14, 5,700 years. And you wait another 5,700 years, and it goes from a half a pound to a quarter pound. So that's half-life. And it's relatively short. And with that half-life, there should be no carbon-14 left after 100 million years. So, you know,
a million years, right?
Half a million years. What did I say? Whatever I said.
You said 100 million.
Sorry. Oh,
no, that's
definitely
right.
Wrong. Too many numbers floating around in my head. Thank you for catching that.
Yeah, no worries.
No carbon-14 atom, not a single atom left in a typical fossil.
And for our, you know, if you're listening to this, the radio carbon dating, just to understand it, C14, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Humphreys, but C14 changes into N14 over time, right? Is that right?
Right.
And so,
but
that's
the thing
what,
is, the thing, yeah, the critical thing about carbon-14 is you get it, if you're an animal, you get it by eating plants, because plants are contaminated it, and the plants get it by breathing carbon dioxide, And there's a process of cosmic rays a process that generates carbon-14 in the atmosphere. So while an animal is alive, he's taking in carbon-14, and it's also decaying, and he just has the same percentage of carbon-14 in his tissues that the air does. But when he dies, he stops taking in food, or stops, if he's a tree, he stops breathing carbon dioxide, and the carbon-14 in its tissues just decays. So that's how the dating method works. If you know how much it had to begin with, then you can tell how long ago it died. But
Now you put on here that C14 only lasts 500,000 years. I've heard it's only 200,000 years. Is that where's the discrepancy there in the what I'm hearing?
carbon-14 has a half-life of not quite 6,000 years, 5,700 years.
Okay. So
I don't
somebody
know
told
where.
me that it gets so small, there's such a small amount that it can no longer actually be measured inside the bone or whatever it is. And so even though there might be some left, that it's so difficult to even measure the quantity that
Yeah,
really you can only
it gets
measure it
below the
for.
detection limit after
Yeah.
several hundred thousand years.
Okay.
But if you carry it out to where there's no atom left, that's about a half million.
Gotcha. Okay.
So not a single carbon-14 atom left. That's well below what they can detect.
Okay,
So
that makes sense.
now the thing is that that's too short for fossils, because most of the fossils are below the ice age, they range from 2 million years old to 560 million years old, according to conventional geology. So for a long
And
time,
when you say below the ice age, you mean that the strata that it's in is
yes, right.
low enough that, okay,
Yes,
yeah.
so you have the ice age gravels and other things on top, and the ice age caves on near the surface, and then you go down into the actual fossil strata, and those are older than 2 million years to 560 million years. So that's for a while, a long time, actually. The experts in carbon-14 thought that they would have a good fossil, a good source of carbon-14 free material to test their machines with. And they thought this up to about 1980, when their detection methods started improving, and they started being able to look at fossils. They thought the fossils would be carbon-14 dead, and it turned out they're carbon-14 alive. They still have much more than the detection limit amount of carbon-14 in them, and that's the problem. So the question is, no carbon-14 in the fossils, really? And no, the answer is that all fossils, all the ones we've checked and they've checked, all of them contain carbon-14, well above the detection limits. So this is from carbon dating journals and also the RATE project. And I'll talk more about the radioisotopes and the age of the Earth project. Coal and wood and shells and bone and marble and natural gas and carbon dioxide gas in the ground and calcite, that's calcium carbonate crystals, and oil and lots of other things, they all contain carbon-14. They're all mildly radioactive. So not as much as people have in them today, but they're still quite, it's far above zero. So there's something wrong with the time scale. So the age of the fossils in years, the conventional age is millions to hundreds of millions. That's just from conventional geology. But if you take what's in the fossils and use the standard dating, carbon-14 dating method, you get roughly 50,000 years. And say from 30,000 to 70,000 years. is the way you would date it. But the average throughout the world and at every depth, the average is about 50,000 years. Now, if you apply a correction, which I won't explain here, that we know about and have evidence for, that 50,000 years drops to about 5,000 years. So carbon 14 is saying something very interesting. It's saying no matter where we go in the world and to what depth in the fossil layers we go, we all get about the same date. And they're all in layers laid down by water, sedimentary rocks mostly. And so the carbon 14 is saying there was some event roughly 5,000 years ago that buried creatures all over the world and made them into fossils.
But because they all contain the amount of C14 that points to a 5,000 year time frame.
Right. Yep. That's it.
I got to ask what knocked off that took it from 50,000 to 5,000. What is that too complex to discuss?
No. I guess we've got time too, don't we? What time
yeah,
are we supposed
time.
To be over with?
Technically around 6:15, but give or take.
Okay. So all right. There's evidence that the carbon 14 increased after the flood quite drastically from about 0.5% of today's ratio of carbon 14. Today's ratio that is in our tissues while we're alive is about 1 out of every trillion carbon atoms is radioactive carbon 14. Now the fossils have at the time, roughly 5,000 years ago, they had about 0.5% of that 1 trillion, 1 out of a trillion ratio. So the fossils had the carbon 14 was low during the flood when the fossils were laid down, and of course just right after the flood. So, but
is this saying that the world was that plants and animals were taking in more C14 prior to the flood than they were after the flood?
Yes, during the ice age, the amount of C14 in the atmosphere increased, bringing that ratio from 0.5% up to about 90% by the time of Moses, by about 1,000 years after the flood. So from 2500 BC to 500 BC, the amount of carbon 14 rose drastically.
And why is that? What is the theory on that?
The bottom line is that when God speeded up radioactive decay, which I'll talk about in a moment, of slow half-life things, he also accelerated nuclear fusion in the sun. And that set in, and I have a whole article about this, and it is pretty technical, but it's in the latest International Conference on Creationism proceedings, which is out. So if you look up on Google, just International Conference on Creationism, and get the latest proceedings, you'll find an article by me on just what I think the sequence of events was. But if you account for this drastic increase of carbon 14 during the ice age, then you shorten the ages.
Well, that's interesting. It seems like an irrefutable fact that the C14 should be all gone in the fossil record if these time frames that evolution claims are the case. Is this changing the paradigm for, some evolutionary scientists? Is it just physicists that are aware of this, because it seems to me that radioisotope dating is the fundamental tool that they always refer to whenever trying to argue for their time frames.
Some of them are painfully aware of it, and they're trying to find all sorts of excuses. They're wriggling and squirming, and they're not going to give up their paradigm easily. And I don't know if some have given up their paradigm, they aren't talking because their evolutionary brothers would castigate them.
Yes, yeah.
So,
they'd be excommunicated.
But we did present this. We presented this at a geoscience conference in San Diego. Let's see, it was about 1994 in the December conference out there. And we had a poster on it, along with a poster about what I'm going to try and talk about next, if we've got time, but I don't know if we've got the time.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Okay, and this covers this is a sample of the billion years dating methods I'm going to show you. It has to do with uranium decaying to lead, for example. That's one of the methods of the billions of years. Oh, so carbon-14, now the creationist friend. Helium leakage from radioactive minerals deflates the idea of billions of years. So in 1974, near Los Alamos, about 20 miles west of the Los Alamos National Labs in the mountains of New Mexico, Los Alamos drilled a hole 3 miles deep. And this is the actual drill rig that they used and that whose core we are using. They extracted core from 3 miles deep. And
incredible.
Most of it was a granitic kind of rock. And if you've looked at granite, there's a black mica, M-I-C-A, this flaky mineral, which is usually white and transparent, but there's a black mica also called biotite. And in the biotite are embedded tiny little crystals of zirconium silicate. And we call that zircon, zircons. And it's not cubic zirconia, which is zirconium oxide. And I think the biblical jacinth is the same mineral. So anyhow, so they got extracted. We extracted them. They extracted the borehole. We took some of the samples and processed them. And here are some crystals, microscopic zircon crystals. They are 60 millionths of a meter long on the average, and that's about 60 germ lengths. A germ is about 1 micron in diameter.
Well, that's small.
But you can see them just barely. They're really tiny, tiny, tiny. So, zircons are radioactive. So they contain uranium. Now, how does that happen? Well, in a molten rock that's cooling down, if it's melted, zircons are the first things that form because they have the highest melting point. So in cooling rock, you have the lattice of zirconium crystals, zircon crystals, starting to form. And as a uranium atom goes by, zircon really likes the uranium atoms. They're just the right size to stuff into their lattice where a zirconium would normally go. So they grab, the forming lattice grabs uranium. But at the same time, there are lead atoms going by and it rejects the lead atoms. And we know this from experiment. We've done it in the lab. And so when zircons form, they have lots of uranium and very little lead. So that'll be important. So take a close look now at radioactivity in a zircon. Uranium decay makes helium and lead. Now, this is a zircon, and here's the uranium atom over on the left, and it's going to decay down to lead 206. And I'm going to show the steps. And at every step, it emits an alpha particle. An alpha particle is the nucleus of a helium atom. It's 2 protons and 2 neutrons. And when the alpha particle stops wherever it stops, it grabs 2 electrons and becomes a full-fledged helium atom. And a lot of these stop within the crystal. So You see eight helium atoms being formed to get down to lead 206. So in nature, we find that the zircons that started with only uranium and no lead, now they have a significant amount of lead in them. So it's very hard for uranium to get into or out of the zircon, and the same for lead. So we know from the lead that a certain amount of uranium decayed, and for every lead 206 atom there is, there were eight helium atoms deposited somewhere. And for this size crystal, about half of them were deposited within the crystal. And so we can tell just from how much lead is there, how many helium atoms were deposited. So now helium is a slippery kind of atom, and it can wiggle out of most minerals. So the question now is how much helium was still left in these zircons. Well, and by the way, and this is important too. If you just look at the uranium and the lead, and you assume today's slow rate of uranium decay, then you get an age of 1.5 billion years for these particular zircons. And Los Alamos calculated about that age, and so did we. So they're supposed to be 1.5 billion years old. But the question is, how much helium is still in them? And the answer is much helium is still in the zircons. So here's a plot showing the depth of the borehole, 0.5 mile all the way down to 2.5 miles, and the temperature about 200 degrees Fahrenheit all the way up to 530 down at the bottom of the borehole. 530 Fahrenheit is about as hot as your oven can get. So I'm going
to
show...
Wow, that's how hot it is that deep down, huh?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to show you how much, what percentage of helium, of the original helium that was deposited, is still in the zircons at each depth here. So at the top, 80%, and it's working its way down, and at the bottom, 2.5 miles deep, 0.1%. So helium has left crystals faster the deeper and hotter their surroundings were. So that's characteristic of a process that we call diffusion, which is just a fancy way for saying spreading out or leakage, but it happens faster at high temperatures. Now I'm going to show a graph for the techies. You do have some techie people who watch?
Yes.
Okay.
And just so I understand, the heat actually is because the molecules, it's causing the molecules to move faster, and that's what's causing them to slip out
yes,
faster?
Yes, the different atoms in the crystal are bouncing around faster and faster, and they're bumping the helium, and they're shoving it from one crystal cell into the next. And so the faster the bumping, the faster the helium gets out. So let's see, here's the graph for the techies. And if you're not a techie, just close your eyes, yawn, go get a drink of water for about half a minute while I explain this, and then we'll get back to something, the bottom line, which is much simpler than the graph. So the question is, how fast did the helium leak? So we measured this. We had it measured by an expert. Our zircons, and helium leaked surprisingly fast at lower temperatures. Now, on the left is diffusivity, or you could say, you could imagine that as a leak rate. And here's temperature at the bottom, on the left, 500 degrees C, and on the right, 0 degrees C. So it's cooler on the right and hotter on the left. And at the high temperatures, the diffusivity, the leakage rate was high, and it dropped as we lowered the temperature in the lab. And then about 300 degrees C, the curve bent over. It stopped going down as fast as it was, and it lagged over. This is something unique. No other group other than RATE, the radioisotopes in the age of the Earth group, has measured zircon leakage, helium leakage in zircons, as far as I know, down at this low temperature below 300. It's I don't know why. They haven't measured it. It's one reason is that it takes a lot more crystals to go down to the low temperatures, and that makes it more expensive. So the experts in helium leakage ignore this bend, and they extrapolate down on the straight line down. But anyhow, well, it's a high leakage rate, and here's the bottom line of how fast it leaks. Helium leaks out so fast that the zircons must be very young. Now we know how much at each depth, we know how much helium was in each crystal, and so we know how much left it. So we took the measured losses and divided by the laboratory measured leak rates. The actual math is more complicated, but this is the sort of the bottom line of the math. And we got a date for each depth. And the depth, the age was the average of at each depth was 6,000 years, give or take 2,000 years. We didn't nail down a lot of the things we needed to nail down better, but this is still very young, 6,000 years, and it's a measurement. So it's a very remarkable result. We
I mean
have,
that's it, right in line with the Bible.
yeah. So we had 1.5 billion years worth of nuclear decay occurring within the last 6,000 years. So we think the only explanation for this we can come up with is that God speeded up nuclear decay for long half-life nuclei, slow decaying nuclei. He speeded it up during the year of the Genesis flood, and probably at another during another episode earlier. He speeded up the decay, and he speeded it up quite drastically.
Could
So
it
it
be that something, during the flood, something about the physics of the flood would speed up the process of helium leakage?
No, a lot of creationists have looked at that, but we have evidence that this happened all through the solar system, and the
Oh,
flood didn't
wow.
occur everywhere in the solar system, and it occurred at various depths in the Earth, which were never reached by the waters. No, it's more like what I think happened is God wanted to accomplish to start up the Genesis flood and to accomplish certain geologic things. He speeded up decay. So he reached out and grabbed the dial on his control board, and that said decay rate, and he gave it a big twist. I think what he did was weaken the strength of the force that holds the nucleus together. It's called a strong nuclear force. But anyhow, that rapid decay releases a lot of heat, and there's a way he could get rid of a lot of heat too. I have a second theory that not many people know about that seems to do a nice biblical job of explaining how he got rid of the heat. So anyhow, so but if you speed up radioactive decay, you're going to collapse the nuclear decay dating methods. You're going to collapse the dates from millions of years down to months. We think we've got the answer.
That's very interesting. So we're coming up on our time here, but Dr. Humphreys, in all these different, I mean, about there's a lot more dating methods too that you're able to explain beyond what you've just explained in the past two shows, right?
Yeah, right.
So do you have one that is your particular favorite that is you feel is the most compelling, or like it's so
It's this one right here.
it is
But I'm
okay.
biased because I was the leader of that particular project for RATE. There were three other guys that worked with me on it, four actually. So I've mentioned RATE. Let me say, here's the technical book that documents those results. Radioisotopes and the Age of the Earth, Volume 2. And RATE is the acronym, Radioisotopes and the Age of the Earth. And you can find
that's a
that.
Great, that's a great acronym.
Yeah, Larry Vardaman thought of that.
That's
so
pretty good.
ICR.org/rate. You can get this book online for free, but beware, it is extremely technical. Okay. So you can use it to impress your friends, but if you actually read it, it's going to be hard work, even for scientists. Now,
have you been able to get this? Have you been able to get this out to, you know, physicists at universities and other research physicists to take a look at this?
Yes, we have. In fact, we got quite a lot of peer review as we were publishing the book. So it went out to experts who peer reviewed this. But also, it's going out by word of mouth. The average creationist layperson knows a professor and ask him, "Have you read the Rate book?" "No, what's the Rate book?" "Oh, well, I just happen to have a copy right here for you."
There you go.
So it's going out at the grassroots level. But we also got a hold of a lot of people at that geoscience conference in 1994 also. So, but there's a layperson's book, explains the rate results. It's thousands, .. not billions, challenging an icon of evolution, questioning the age of the Earth. And it's written by Dr. Don DeYoung, and he was a physicist on the rate group. And Larry picked him to translate all the technical stuff into good, readable stuff. So because Don is a very good science, popular science writer. And so it's highly readable, but it's written by a physicist and has many details. Thousands, not billions. You can get
and
that.
And where can people get that? Creationresearch.org?
Creationresearch.org or ICR's. Oh, no, this one's creationresearch.org. And you can get an ebook form of it on Amazon.com, and you may be able to get it at creation.com. I don't know. So the bottom line of what I'm saying is that it's a young world after all. So the data for youth heavily outweighs the data for age. And the carbon rate data explains nuclear dating ages, including carbon-14 and the old other methods. So I want you to be able to trust the Bible, folks. Here's my favorite verse for what the Bible says. "For in 6 days Jehovah made the heavens and the earth." Exodus 20:11. That's in the Ten Commandments, not in Genesis. And the context is ordinary days of the week. So in 6 ordinary weekdays, the Lord made the whole universe. And hope this is helpful for people. And here, again, are some of those websites. That's about all I had to say, Kevin. So, but...
Oh, I love it. I love it. And Exodus 20:11, right? You can't say it's poetry or something, right? It's not in Genesis 1. 1 through 11. So there you go. The
no,
Bible says it. And go ahead.
It's in the 10 suggestions, the one about telling the Israelites to honor the Sabbath day. But the justification is for in 6 of those type of days, he made the whole universe.
That's right. You know, and I always have people that say to me, if you're listening, you know, I frequently will have people say, "Oh, why make a big deal out of the age of the earth? Or why even argue about this?" You know, and the reality is that this is a fantastic, first of all, the Bible says it. And so it's the plain reading of the text. It's the straightforward reading of the text. If you have good hermeneutics, you're going to come to the conclusion that it's a 6-day creation and it's only about a 6,000 year old creation. And so, and the other thing is that once you dismantle this whole, you know, deep time evolutionary time frame, evolution is gone. You know, it's not an obstacle anymore. There's no more trying to justify, you know, the possibility that we somehow exist without God. And so it's a fantastic tool to be able to minister to people and to witness to people by giving the evidence for a recent creation. And so don't shy away from it. I say embrace it, and then go. I love just going out and talking to people about it, because a lot of people have just never heard this stuff, and when they hear it, they're just
Yeah.
like, "What?" And
That's right.
you'll see light bulbs go on in their eyes,
Yeah.
and a lot of people get excited. So
Yeah. It
I think
makes
it's
sense
great.
of both the Bible and science. You know, the Bible wouldn't
Yep.
make any sense. Doesn't really. There's no way you can jam billions of years into it without doing violence to a number of scriptures. If you take it at face value, you get a good explanation of the science facts. So
Yeah.
it's just that the old billions of years is it's an origins myth that has gripped the entire world, people are really hard if people find it hard to let go of their origins myth.
Yeah. Well, you're doing incredible work, and you are making a difference, along with so many other scientists like yourself. Like I said, the most recent poll in 2019 says that 40% of Americans believe in a recent creation, just like the Bible says. So that should be inspiring to everybody. You can make a difference, and the arguments are sound, and the evidence is there. So that's wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Humphreys.
Well, my privilege, and thank you for telling me that, by the way. And the 40% is something I didn't know about. So,
Yeah. I was talking to Dr. John Sanford a little while ago, and he was discouraged, saying, another guy I was talking to were a little discouraged, and you know what? We just keep moving forward, and I know that it's having an impact. So I see it in my students' lives. I teach 12th grade seniors in Christian high school, and I see it happening with them. Right, it's making a difference in their lives. So that's awesome.
yeah, it does. So,
Okay, well, we'll probably ask you to join us again in the future, Dr. Humphreys, just because you're a wealth of information, and there's so much stuff I'd like to ask you about. So we'll probably connect with you in a couple months.
okay. Let's do that.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. For those of you who have tuned in, again, this was, if you're listening on podcast, you missed out a lot on a lot of the slides, a lot of really good stuff on here. So check it out on YouTube. You'll get more information. You'll be able to see all the details of what Dr. Humphreys talked about. And he's got articles all over the place if you want to check them out. If you want to check out my website, educateforlife.org, I've got all kinds of useful educational tools up there for helping your kids grow up to have a biblical worldview, building confident Christians. That's educateforlife.org. You can check that out. And all my past radio shows are up there too. And we've got, like I said, archaeologist Douglas Petrovich coming up not too far away. We're going to be talking about the original language before the Tower of Babel, which, as Dr. Humphreys said, looks like it was a form of Hebrew. So that should be really exciting too. I hope you have a great night tonight, and continue to trust the Bible. God bless you, and have a great night.